The Marble Faun by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Chapter 44. The Deserted Shrine. Kenyon knew the sanctity which Hilda, faithful Protestant and daughter of the Puritans as the girl was, imputed to this shrine. He was aware of the profound feeling of responsibility, as well earthly as religious, with which her conscience had been impressed when she became the occupant of her aerial chamber and undertook the task of keeping the consecrated lamp alight. There was an accuracy and a certainty about Hilda's movements as regarded all matters that lay deep enough to have their roots in right or wrong, which made it possible and safe to rely upon the timely and careful trimming of this lamp, if she were in life and able to creep up the steps, as upon the rising of tomorrow's sun with luster undiminished from today. The sculptor could scarcely believe his eyes, therefore, when he saw the flame flicker and expire. His sight had surely deceived him, and now, since the light did not reappear, there must be some smoke wreath or impenetrable mist brooding about the tower's gray old head and obscuring it from the lower world. But no, for right above the dim battlements, as the wind chased away a mass of clouds, he beheld a star, and moreover, by an earnest concentration of his sight, was soon able to discern even the darkened shrine itself. There was no obscurity around the tower, no infirmity of his own vision. The flame had exhausted its supply of oil and become extinct. But where was Hilda? A man in a cloak happened to be passing, and Kenyon, anxious to distrust the testimony of his senses if he could get more acceptable evidence on the other side, appealed to him. "Do me the favor, signore," said he, "to look at the top of yonder tower and tell me whether you see the lamp burning at the Virgin's shrine." "The lamp, signore?" answered the man, without at first troubling himself to look up. "The lamp that has burned these 400 years? How is it possible, signora, that it should not be burning now?" "But look," said the sculptor impatiently. With good-natured indulgence for what he seemed to consider as the whim of an eccentric forestiero, the Italian carelessly threw his eyes upward. But as soon as he perceived that there was really no light, he lifted his hands with a vivid expression of wonder and alarm. "The lamp is extinguished!" cried he. "The lamp that has been burning these 400 years, this surely must portend some great misfortune. And by my advice, signore, you will hasten hence, lest the tower tumble on our heads. A priest once told me that if the Virgin withdrew her blessing and the light went out, the old Palazzo del Torre would sink into the earth with all that dwell in it. There will be a terrible crash before morning." The stranger made the best of his way from the doomed premises, while Kenyon, who would willingly have seen the tower crumble down before his eyes on condition of Hilda's safety, determined, late as it was, to attempt ascertaining if she were in her dovecote. Passing through the arched entrance, which, as is often the case with Roman entrances, was as accessible at midnight as at noon, he groped his way to the broad staircase, and, lighting his wax taper, went glimmering up the multitude of steps that led to Hilda's door. The hour being so unseasonable, he intended merely to knock, and, as soon as her voice from within should reassure him, to retire, keeping his explanations and apologies for a fitter time. Accordingly, reaching the lofty height where the maiden, as he trusted, lay asleep with angels watching over her, though the Virgin seemed to have suspended her care, he tapped lightly at the door panels, then knocked more forcibly, then thundered an impatient summons. No answer came. Hilda, evidently, was not there. After assuring himself that this must be the fact, Kenyon descended the stairs, but made a pause at every successive stage and knocked at the door of its apartment, regardless whose slumbers he might disturb in his anxiety to learn where the girl had last been seen. But at each closed entrance there came those hollow echoes which a chamber or any dwelling, great or small, never sends out in response to human knuckles or iron hammer, as long as there is life within to keep its heart from getting dreary. Once, indeed, on the lower landing place, the sculptor fancied that there was a momentary stir inside the door, as if somebody were listening at the threshold. He hoped at least that the small iron-barred aperture would be unclosed, through which Roman housekeepers are wont to take careful cognizance of applicants for admission, from a traditionary dread, perhaps, of letting in a robber or assassin. But it remained shut, neither was the sound repeated, and Kenyon concluded that his excited nerves had played a trick upon his senses, as they are apt to do when we most wish for the clear evidence of the latter. There was nothing to be done, save to go heavily away, and await whatever good or ill tomorrow's daylight might disclose. Betimes in the morning, therefore, Kenyon went back to the Via Portuguesi before the slant rays of the sun had descended halfway down the gray front of Hilda's tower. As he drew near its base, he saw the doves perched in full session on the sunny height of the battlements, and a pair of them, who were probably their mistress's especial pets, and the confidants of her bosom secrets, if Hilda had any, came shooting down and made a feint of alighting on his shoulder. But though they evidently recognized him, their shyness would not yet allow so decided a demonstration. Kenyon's eyes followed them as they flew upward, hoping that they might have come as joyful messengers of the girl's safety, and that he should discern her slender form, half hidden by the parapet, trimming the extinguished lamp at the Virgin's shrine, just as other maidens set about the little duties of a household. Or perhaps he might see her gentle and sweet face smiling down upon him midway towards heaven, as if she had flown thither for a day or two just to visit her kindred, but had been drawn earthward again by the spell of unacknowledged love. But his eyes were blessed by no such fair vision or reality, nor, in truth, were the eager, unquiet flutterings of the doves indicative of any joyful intelligence which they longed to share with Hilda's friend, but of anxious inquiries that they knew not how to utter. They could not tell any more than he whither their lost companion had drawn herself, but were in the same void despondency with him, feeling their sunny and airy lives darkened and grown imperfect now that her sweet society was taken out of it. In the brisk morning air, Kenyon found it much easier to pursue his researches than at the preceding midnight, when, if any slumberers heard the clamor that he made, they had responded only with sullen and drowsy maledictions, and turned to sleep again. It must be a very dear and intimate reality for which people will be content to give up a dream. When the sun was fairly up, however, it was quite another thing. The heterogeneous population inhabiting the lower floor of the old tower and the other extensive regions of the palace were now willing to tell all they knew and imagine a great deal more. The amiability of these Italians, assisted by their sharp and nimble wits, caused them to overflow with plausible suggestions and to be very bounteous in their avowals of interest for the lost Hilda. In a less demonstrative people, such expressions would have implied an eagerness to search land and sea and never rest till she were found. In the mouths that uttered them, they meant good wishes and were, so far, better than indifference. There was little doubt that many of them felt a genuine kindness for the shy, brown-haired, delicate young foreign maiden who had flown from some distant land to alight upon their tower, where she consorted only with the doves. But their energy expended itself in exclamation, and they were content to leave all more active measures to Kenyon and to the Virgin, whose affair it was to see that the faithful votary of her lamp received no harm. In a great Parisian domicile, multifarious as its inhabitants might be, the concierge under the archway would be cognizant of all their incomings and issuings forth. But except in rare cases, the general entrance and main staircase of a Roman house are left as free as the street, of which they form a sort of by-lane. The sculptor, therefore, could hope to find information about Hilda's movements only from casual observers. On probing the knowledge of these people to the bottom, there was various testimony as to the period whence the girl had last been seen. Some said it was 4 days since there had been a trace of her, but an English lady in the second piano of the palace was rather of opinion that she had met her the morning before with a drawing-book in her hand. Having no acquaintance with the young person, she had taken little notice and might have been mistaken. A count on the piano next above was very certain that he had lifted his hat to Hilda under the archway 2 afternoons ago. An old woman, who had formerly tended the shrine, threw some light upon the matter by testifying that the lamp required to be replenished once at least in 3 days, though its reservoir of oil was exceedingly capacious. On the whole, though, there was other evidence enough to create some perplexity. Kenyon could not satisfy himself that she had been visible since the afternoon of the third preceding day, when a fruit seller remembered her coming out of the arched passage with a sealed packet in her hand. As nearly as he could ascertain, this was within an hour after Hilda had taken leave of the sculptor at his own studio, with the understanding that they were to meet at the Vatican the next day. 2 nights, therefore, had intervened during which the lost maiden was unaccounted for. The door of Hilda's apartments was still locked, as on the preceding night, But Kenyon sought out the wife of the person who sublet them, and prevailed on her to give him admittance by means of the duplicate key which the good woman had in her possession. On entering, the maidenly neatness and simple grace, recognizable in all the arrangements, made him visibly sensible that this was the daily haunt of a pure soul in whom religion and love of beauty were at one. Thence, the sturdy Roman matron led the sculptor across a narrow passage and threw open the door of a small chamber, on the threshold of which he reverently paused. Within, there was a bed covered with white drapery and closed with snowy curtains, like a tent, and of barely width enough for a slender figure to repose upon it. The sight of this cool, airy, and secluded bower caused the lover's heart to stir, as if enough of Hilda's gentle dreams were lingering there to make him happy for a single instant. But then came the closer consciousness of her loss, bringing along with it a sharp sting of anguish. "Behold, signore," said the matron, "here is the little staircase by which the signorina used to ascend and trim the Blessed Virgin's lamp. She was worthy to be a Catholic, such pains the good child bestowed to keep it burning, and doubtless the Blessed Mary will intercede for her, in consideration of her pious offices, heretic though she was. What will become of the old palazzo now that the lamp is extinguished, the saints above us only know. Will you mount, signore, to the battlements, and see if she has left any trace of herself there?" The sculptor stepped across the chamber and ascended the little staircase which gave him access to the breezy summit of the tower. It affected him inexpressibly to see a bouquet of beautiful flowers beneath the shrine, and to recognize in them an offering of his own to Hilda, who had put them in a vase of water and dedicated them to the Virgin in a spirit, partly fanciful perhaps, but still partaking of the religious sentiment which so profoundly influenced her character. One rosebud, indeed, she had selected for herself from the rich mass of flowers, for Kenyon well remembered recognizing it in her bosom when he last saw her at the studio. "That little part of my great love she took," said he to himself. "The remainder she would have devoted to heaven, but has left it withering in the sun and wind. Ah, Hilda, Hilda, had you given me a right to watch over you, this evil had not come." "Be not downcast, signorino mio," said the Roman matron, in response to the deep sigh which struggled out of Kenyon's breast. "The dear little maiden, as we see, has decked yonder blessed shrine as devoutly as I myself or any other good Catholic woman could have done. It is a religious act, and has more than the efficacy of a prayer. The signorina will as surely come back as the sun will fall through the window tomorrow, no less than today. Her own doves have often been missing for a day or two, but they were sure to come fluttering about her head again when she least expected them. So will it be with this dove-like child." "It might be so," thought Kenyon with yearning anxiety, "if a pure maiden were as safe as a dove in this evil world of ours." As they returned through the studio with the furniture and arrangements of which the sculptor was familiar, he missed a small ebony writing desk that he remembered as having always been placed on a table there. He knew that it was Hilda's custom to deposit her letters in this desk, as well as other little objects of which she wished to be especially careful. "What has become of it?" he suddenly inquired, laying his hand on the table. "Become of what, pray?" exclaimed the woman, a little disturbed. "Does the signor suspect a robbery, then?" "The signorina's writing desk is gone," replied Kenyon. "It always stood on this table. I myself saw it there only a few days ago." "Ah, well," said the woman, recovering her composure, which she seemed partly to have lost, "the signorina has doubtless taken it away with her. The fact is of good omen, for it proves that she did not go unexpectedly, and is likely to return when it may best suit her convenience." "This is very singular," observed Kenyon. "Have the rooms been entered by yourself or any other person since the signorina's disappearance?"
"Not by me, signora, so help me heaven and the saints," said the matron. "And I question whether there are more than two keys in Rome that will suit this strange old lock. Here is one, and as for the other, the signorina carries it in her pocket."
The sculptor had no reason to doubt the word of this respectable dame. She appeared to be well-meaning and kind-hearted, as Roman matrons generally are, except when a fit of passion incites them to shower horrible curses on an obnoxious individual, or perhaps to stab him with the steel stiletto that serves them for a hairpin. But Italian asseverations of any questionable fact, however true they may chance to be, have no witness of their truth in the faces of those who utter them. Their words are spoken with strange earnestness, and yet do not vouch for themselves as coming from any depth,
like roots drawn out of the substance of the soul with some of the soil clinging to them. There is always a something inscrutable instead of frankness in their eyes. In short, they lie so much like truth and speak truth so much as if they were telling a lie that their auditor suspects himself in the wrong, whether he believes or disbelieves them, it being the one thing certain that falsehood is seldom an intolerable burden to the tenderest of Italian consciences. "It is very strange what can have become of the desk," repeated Kenyon, looking the woman in the face. "Very strange indeed, signora," she replied meekly, without turning away her eyes in the least, but checking his insight of them at about half an inch below the surface. "I think the signorina must have taken it with her." It seemed idle to linger here any longer. Kenyon therefore departed after making an arrangement with the woman, by the terms of which she was to allow the apartment to remain in their present state on his assuming the responsibility for the rent. He spent the day in making such further search and investigation as he found practicable, and, though at first trammelled by an unwillingness to draw public attention to Hilda's affairs, the urgency of the circumstances soon compelled him to be thoroughly in earnest. In the course of a week he tried all conceivable modes of fathoming the mystery, not merely by his personal efforts and those of his brother artists and friends, but through the police, who readily undertook the task and expressed strong confidence of success. But the Roman police has very little efficiency, except in the interest of the despotism of which it is a tool. With their cocked hats, shoulder belts, and swords, they wear a sufficiently imposing aspect, and doubtless keep their eyes open wide enough to track a political offender, but are too often blind to private outrage, be it murder or any lesser crime. Kenyon counted little upon their assistance, and profited by it not at all. Remembering the mystic words which Miriam had addressed to him, he was anxious to meet her, but knew not whither she had gone, nor how to obtain an interview either with herself or Donatello. The days wore away, and still there were no tidings of the lost one, no lamp rekindled before the Virgin's shrine, no light shining into the lover's heart, no star of hope, he was ready to say, as he turned his eyes almost reproachfully upward in heaven itself. The end of chapter 44. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.